Chapter 61. Protection Rackets. In the year 1880, an English clergyman named Rose was travelling with two Italian companions through Sicily. They were about a mile from the railway station at Lecrera, when quite suddenly they found themselves surrounded by bearded, rough-looking men who carried knives and carbines. This was the gang of a notorious brigand, Leoni, whose name was feared all over Sicily. The gang released Rose's companions, who were told to go to the Italian authorities in Palermo and to report that the Reverend Rose was being held for a ransom of £5,000. The authorities were concerned but penurious. They reported the incident to the British consul and then forgot it. A few weeks later, they received a parcel containing one of Mr. Rose's ears. The British government, stirred by the clamour in the newspapers, decided to pay the ransom. But before they had completed the endless formalities, the brigands had grown impatient and sent another ear, together with a note saying that if the ransom still wasn't paid, Mr. Rose would be chopped up piecemeal. The British were now enraged. They paid the £5,000 and recovered the earless Mr. Rose. And they also made such threatening noises that the Italian government sent an army into the mountains. There was a bloody battle. Leoni himself was killed and most of his men were captured. The British newspapers congratulated themselves for forcing the Italians to do something that they should have done years ago, and the affair was almost forgotten. But not entirely. For the most dangerous of the gang had escaped, together with six companions. His name was Giuseppe Esposito. He was a small, evil-looking man with a cruel mouth and a low forehead. Friends in Palermo smuggled Esposito onto a ship bound for the United States, and he landed in New York and made his way to New Orleans with a few selected followers. There, under the name of Razzo, he rented a house in Charters Street and bought himself a boat, probably with his share of the clergyman's ransom, and then dredged for oysters. He was so confident that he was a free man in America that he called the boat Leoni, and he flew the bandit's flag from the mast. But respectability bored Esposito. He had been a bandit for too long to enjoy making money legitimately. There were no mountains here to hide in, but there were plenty of wealthy Italians in New Orleans. Giuseppe Esposito called on some of them, and he explained that he needed money to finance a fleet of boats. When they asked what guarantee he could offer in return for a loan, Esposito would casually take out a revolver and cock it, peering down the sights. And then, with slow deliberation, he would pull the trigger. The hammer clicked onto the empty chamber. Pretending not to notice the trembling of his startled host, he would say deliberately, "Protezione," protection. It's possible that Giuseppe Esposito was not the originator of this popular euphemism, but he was certainly one of the first of the American gangsters to employ the method. In fact, he got his loan from Italian grocers and restaurateurs who understood the value of Esposito's goodwill, and he proceeded to organise his local Black Hand gang along the same lines as the great Leoni. He began by deposing the leader of the local mafia, Tony Labruzzo, who lacked Esposito's casual ferocity. Then he bought a fleet of boats and ships and conducted elaborate piracy operations on the Mississippi and in the Gulf of Mexico. With his brigand's instinct for a hideout, he had huts constructed in the depths of the swamps. He intended to conduct his protection racket along Italian lines, that is, to kidnap anyone who refused to pay and to hold him for ransom. The Italians, with their regard for property, would only use vandalism as a last resort. However, Esposito was never to achieve his ambition to become the Leoni of Louisiana. His deposed rival, Tony Labruzzo, told the Italian consul that Leoni's chief lieutenant was in New Orleans, and the chief of police, Thomas Boylan, kept Esposito under surveillance. He learned that two New York detectives, James Mooney and D. Boland, had been hired by the Italian government to find Esposito. For weeks, two of Boylan's best men, the brothers David and Mike Hennessy, shadowed Esposito. And then, one day, when they received word to pick him up, they quickly moved in on their quarry as he walked across Jackson Square. They pushed guns into his ribs and they rushed him to the police station. It had to be done quickly. The mafia were capable of storming the jail. Early the next morning, Esposito was taken downriver and put on board a ship for New York. Deported to Italy, he was tried and sentenced to life imprisonment, in irons. But before he went on trial, Tony Labruzzo, the man who had betrayed him, was already dead, shot down in the street by a mafioso. The Black Hand knew that if it was to maintain its stranglehold on the Italian community, it had to gain a reputation for absolute ruthlessness and terrible efficiency. The two Hennessy brothers left New Orleans, but Mike was killed in 1886 and David in 1890, both by Mafia gunmen. Of course, Esposito was not the inventor of protection. It had been known on the border of England and Scotland as far back as the 16th century, when bands of wanted men, led by local chieftains, extorted a second rent, or mail, from the local farmers by threatening to burn their farms and to destroy their crops. This was the origin of the word blackmail. In Sicily and Corsica, both islands with violent histories, brigands maintained themselves by extorting food and other necessities from the population. But protection was rare, for obvious reasons. The wealthy citizens lived in the towns, where they were fairly well protected by the police, and the brigands were in the mountains. In Naples, there was a flourishing secret society called the Camorra, which certainly included protection amongst its many activities, but in Sicily, the original mafia was basically an alternative to the police, providing quite genuine protection and other favours for those people who paid a certain sum. In its early stages, it was a protection racket, only in the same sense as Securicorps. In America, gangs had always abounded. In the early 19th century, the New York slums were full of outfits with names like the Dead Rabbits, the Plug Uglies, the Five Points. These specialised in burglary, theft from docks and warehouses, receiving stolen property, intimidation of prostitutes, and all the usual extra-legal activities of slum dwellers with more than the customary share of dominance. The same was true of San Francisco, Chicago, and other fast-growing towns. Los Angeles was, at this time, a tiny and peaceful village with no law enforcement problem. Politicians discovered the use of gangs to bully voters, and by the 1850s, the New York gangs and the Tammany Hall bosses were in close alliance. A man about to enter a polling booth was likely to be stopped by a man with a cosh and asked how he intended to vote. If he mentioned the wrong name, he never got inside. The roughnecks would do the voting instead. In the 1860s, the Chinese in the goldfields near Marysville, California, organised themselves into secret societies called tongs. The first two were known as the Hop Sings and the Sui Sings, and they came into violent conflict when the mistress of a Hop Sing member was stolen by somebody from the Sui Sings. The girl was only handed back after many men on both sides had died. The tongs moved to railroad construction camps and then to the larger towns, the chief of which was San Francisco, known for its brothels and its gambling houses. The average Chinese in America were a docile and well-behaved people, too docile in many ways, for the whites preyed on them unmercifully. Their two chief necessities were opium, which had been introduced into China by the British, and girls. There was a flourishing traffic in girls who were glad to get away from the terrible poverty of their own land to the relative luxury of sharing a cellar with 20 other slaves. The tongs were probably the first large-scale protection racket in America, and this was largely because they organised the lives of their fellow citizens in this foreign country and got them to pay a proportion of their wages. If a Chinaman established himself enough to want to bring his wife to America, the tong demanded a certain payment. The tongs had a simple way of enforcing their will, murder. Their assassins preferred hatchets, hence the term hatchet man, but also carried a silk rope around the body, like the thugs of India. Their protection was genuine, like that of the mafia in Sicily. In San Francisco in 1875, a hatchet man named Ming Long of the Kwong Dok Tong came upon Lo Sing, a member of the Sui Sing Tong, holding the hand of a pretty slave girl named Kum Ho, and he split his skull with a hatchet. Before he died, Lo Sing gasped out the name of his killer to the head of his tong. Formal challenges were sent, and the next day at midnight the deadliest hatchet men of both tongs met in a certain street in Chinatown and fought earnestly and bloodily until the police, mostly Irish, arrived with their whistles and nightsticks. No one was killed, although some died later. The Sui Sings were held to have won because they had injured a large number of the enemy. Payment was made to Lo Sing's relatives. Ming Long was formally ejected from the tong, which meant that he was fair game for any hatchet man, and fled to China, where the tongs did not exist. The historian of San Francisco, Herbert Asbury, points out that both the tongs and the chop suey were invented by the Chinese in America. The Italians were the next great wave of immigrants to arrive in New York, fleeing from political troubles at home. The first generation settled down to hard work, running shops, restaurants and small businesses, and eventually many of them became prosperous. It was then that new arrivals like Giuseppe Esposito began to prey on these more successful countrymen, and the protection racket as we know it today came into being. The rise of the gangs was very slow, and most non-Italian Americans knew very little about them until the year 1890. After Esposito had been deported back to Italy and a life in chains, two New Orleans brothers named Charles and Tony Matranga decided that there were better ways of making money than in the saloon business. Inspired by Esposito's efficient takeover of New Orleans crime, they settled down to the business of organising the gangs and extorting protection from their fellow Italians. Many Italians in New Orleans worked in the docks at the fairly reasonable wage of 40 cents an hour. A rich and influential family named Provenzano had a monopoly of unloading fruit ships from South America. Charles Matranga approached them and suggested that in future they might like to obtain their dock labour through him. Naturally, the labourers also paid the Matrangas a kickback for their good services. The Matrangas had discovered what Esposito knew, that a few dominant human beings can always lead a large number of non-dominant ones by the nose. In those days, zoologists knew very little about animal dominance and had certainly never heard that precisely 5% of any animal group is dominant. Most human beings make the very natural assumption that most other human beings love their independence and will fight for it, and it's true that all animals, including humans, will fight grimly for their own territory. But it's also true that in any casually chosen group of 20 men, one is a leader and can impose his will on the other 19. Dictators like Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini owed their power to this biological peculiarity, and so did the Matrangas. If there had been any concerted resistance, no doubt they would have gone back to keeping a saloon and a brothel. But their army of labourers handed over 10% of their wages without protest. The Provenzanos paid the Matrangas for their services as a labour exchange, and suddenly the latter were on the road to being rich. And then one day it struck them that the reason the Provenzanos didn't mind paying them protection was because they were making such an excellent income from the fruit ships they unloaded. After all, the labour force belonged to the Matrangas. And so the Matrangas told the Provenzanos that from now on they would cease to act as middlemen. Instead, the Matrangas would take over the loading and unloading of the ships. And to underline the point, Provenzano managers and foremen were badly beaten up. The Provenzanos gave in to the blackmail, and the Matrangas, still slightly astonished at the ease with which it had all been accomplished, were the masters of all the Italian casual labour in New Orleans. But the Matrangas made the mistake of carrying on their war against the Provenzanos. They began to harass their grocery business. In desperation, the Provenzanos hired their own gunmen, and there were clashes in the streets. David Hennessy, one of the brothers who had captured Esposito, knew and liked the Provenzanos. He had an intense dislike of the Matrangas organisation of murder and extortion, which had killed his brother Mike in Houston in Texas 5 years after Esposito's arrest. When he was appointed chief of police, Hennessy decided he would stamp out the mafia. One morning in 1890, a truckload of Provenzano men were on their way to work at a dock that had still not been taken over by the Matrangas. Suddenly, men with shotguns appeared out of the darkness and began firing indiscriminately. Since they were using buckshot, the darkness made no difference. Two men were killed and many others were wounded. Hennessy decided that this was the last straw, and he began collecting evidence of mafia activity in New Orleans. An anonymous letter warned him that he would be killed if he continued, but he ignored it. He corresponded with the Rome police, asking for the names and photographs of some of Esposito's old gang. And in April 1890, the Provenzanos retaliated by ambushing Tony Matranga and two of his henchmen. They succeeded in wounding them. Matranga identified two of his assailants as Joe and Pete Provenzano. The police had no alternative but to arrest them, and their trial was set for October the 17th. David Hennessy declared publicly that he would appear in the witness stand for the Provenzanos and make their trial the opportunity to divulge information about the mafia in New Orleans. But he never reached the courtroom. For at midnight on October the 15th, 1890, Hennessy turned into Basin Street, and three men jumped out of a doorway to riddle him with bullets. The dying man pulled out his own revolver and succeeded in firing 4 shots at the fleeing assassins, but he died as he reached the hospital. This was too much, to shoot down a chief of police who was doing his best to stamp out organised crime. It was a direct confrontation between the criminals and the rest of society. Hennessy's investigations had disclosed that, in Sicily, the mafia was stronger than the police, but it should never happen in America. Feeling against Italians became so intense that they began to be afraid of venturing outdoors during daylight. Many were attacked in the street. Hennessy's files quickly provided the police with 11 strong suspects. The 11 men were arrested the day after the police chief's murder. One of them was a man called Antoni Scafidi. On the day after he was arrested, a young man named Duffy walked into the jail and asked to see Scafidi. The prisoner was brought out. Duffy suddenly produced a revolver and fired. The bullet only wounded Scafidi. Asked why he had done it, Duffy said that if there were more men like him in New Orleans, the mafia would soon cease to exist. Naturally, his sentence was light. 21 Italians were eventually arrested, including Charles Matranga and a 14-year-old boy who was accused of signalling Hennessy's approach to the killers. The law-abiding citizens of New Orleans sighed with relief. It looked as if justice would be done after all. The trial of 9 of the Italians, including Matranga, was set for February of 1891. But soon the citizens began to suspect that justice was not going to have its way after all. The Matrangas could afford expensive lawyers, and a great battery of legal talents were lined up for the defence. The evidence at the trial was overwhelming. Many witnesses came forward to say that they had seen some of the defendants running away from the scene of Hennessy's murder. One defendant broke down and confessed to being present at a meeting of the mafia when Hennessy's death was decreed. It ought to have been an open and shut case. But halfway through the trial, the judge ordered the acquittal of the 14-year-old boy and also of Charles Matranga. The jury retired, and when they returned, their verdict was that 4 of the accused were not guilty and that they were unable to agree about 3 others, including Scafidi. It was obvious that the jurors had either been bribed or intimidated, and that the same applied to many of the lawyers on the case. The Italian colony added insult to injury by holding parties in the streets to celebrate the acquittal of the 9, which everyone expected to be a prelude to the dismissal of the case against the others. A gang of Sicilians tore down an American flag and trampled it in the mud before hanging it upside down below the flag of Italy. For the citizens of New Orleans, that was the final indignity. In the morning newspapers of March the 14th, advertisements requested all good citizens to attend a mass meeting that evening and to come prepared for action. It was signed by 61 prominent citizens, and that evening a seething crowd filled Canal Street. The 61 citizens appeared, and some of them spoke briefly from the pedestal of a statue of Henry Clay, declaring that it was necessary for the people to take justice into their own hands. The men led the crowd to a gun store and handed out rifles, and then they marched on the prison. The prison governor locked all the prisoners in their cells, except for the Italians, who were told to find hiding places. The execution squad, led by William Parkinson, a well-known local figure, broke open a wooden door at the back of the prison, stationed armed guards there, and then went deliberately through the jail, seeking out the 11 Italians who were believed beyond doubt to be guilty of murder. Oddly enough, this list didn't include Charles Matranga. These 11 men were dragged out and killed, 9 shot, 2 hanged. And then, in good order, the Avengers marched out. The mob dispersed quietly. It was the end of mafia power in New Orleans. There was an attempted revival in 1900 when the Black Hand kidnapped the child, Walter LaManna, and killed him. But when the gang members were arrested and tried, this second rebirth also came to an end.